Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. We are going to have such a good time. Take your mind off all your problems. Take your mind off the troubled world. And by the way, if you can't be with us today until 3 o'clock, we start at 1, you can always go to the podcast. We are there all the time. You go to WABCradio.com, The Joan Hamburg Show, also on Facebook, on Twitter, and we're happy to hear from you and even answer all your questions. So much is going on in the city. The theater season is just about swinging into gear. New shows are opening all the time. By the way, I think the most frequently asked question I get is, where can I eat in the theater district? And I always say, if I could invent a new restaurant, I would. But there is a fairly new restaurant. It's delicious. It's on 44th Street and 10th Avenue, right there, little place, 607 10th, Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, called Meme, which means grandma, grandmother. And I sort of fell into it by accident. I had the most delicious. We had some appetizers, delicious hummus and a lot of Middle Eastern stuff. And then I had a brochette, a lovely skewer of delicious giant shrimp and scallops. And if you like tuna, they had tuna with wonderful grains and fresh homemade pita, a really good restaurant to know about and very, very inexpensive. So add this to your list. You're going to the theater. This is a good one, and it's not going to break the bank. M-E-M-E, 607 10th Avenue. I sort of feel guilty telling you about it because it's small. There's another one downtown, too, but we're always looking in the theater for places to go. With all these shows coming in, that's something you want to do. Speaking of things coming in, the Big Apple Circus. The season is about to begin. It's a really child-friendly circus. You know, when my kids were little and I would take them to Ringling Brothers, they were scared a lot. It was big. It was like in your face. A great circus, but now they don't have that. However, the Big Apple is so user-friendly, and it's really important because the circus audience today is very different. There's a one-ring circus. No seat is more than 50 feet away, so every kid can see it. There are very reasonable tickets, and I really highly recommend this. Something nice to do for the family. And as circuses are becoming harder and harder to find, this is one that you definitely are going to want to do. And one more thing I want to mention, too. The Big Apple Circus, I told you, but the Lion King. Hard to believe when shows most can't even make it on Broadway for four performances. The Lion King, 20 years, and they're giving a free performance at the Minskoff Theater November 15th on Wednesday. It's lottery, though. So on 11/12 Times Square, and lottery locations across the five boroughs. It's a terrific celebration. They say they're going to thank the city of New York. And it's for a Wednesday, November 15th performance, 8 o'clock at the Minskoff. So on Sunday, November 12th, you can enter in Times Square. And it's by Broadway Direct. You have to be in person. You could go to Times Square between 45th and 46th Street is one of the good locations for it. Queens Library, noon to 4:30. The New York Public Library, the Bronx Library Center, 12 to 6. Those are a couple of thoughts to see one of the really great shows. So it's worth it if you're in the city. Come and try to get yourself a lottery ticket. Meanwhile, we've got Susie Essman, who's always the funniest person in town. She's coming along. And then chef owner, a great food personality, Dan Barba. Oh, we've got a lot of show for you, so stay tuned.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. One of my favorite people, a great actress, a wonderful comedian, a terrific writer, a really unusual person who has certainly paid her dues in the world of entertainment, is back on the great HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm, where Susie Essman plays Susie Green of the great Big Mouth. And she's played Susie Green for all of the 8 seasons of this series. No one does a better job at sarcasm, at insults. In fact, I'm sure that when Susie reflects upon this, it's hard to believe that she is beloved for her great big foul mouth. How are you, dear Susie?
I'm good. You're right. I never thought that I was going to be beloved for telling people to go, you know what.
Amazing, right? And the thing is, I've loved this show from day one, but the character really evolved. It wasn't until, at least in my memory, a couple of turns in that you really opened up. And I was trying to remember, wasn't that the episode when you couldn't find your kid's beloved doll's head?
Well, that was in season two. The doll was in season two, where I think Susie really came into her own, where you really saw how Jeff and Larry lived in fear of her. And that's where I got that spaghetti western theme music, you know, that Larry
right.
was in. But it was in season one, which was way back in 2000, 17 years ago, that he hired me for a scene called The Wire, where a Fresh Air Fund kid, Jeff brings a Fresh Air Fund kid into our house, and the kid robs us blind, and then Susie then rips Jeff apart. And that was the scene he had in mind in season one that he hired me for.
And didn't he see you? I think you told me that you were performing at a Friar's Roast.
Yeah, well, it was a Friar's Roast of
Jerry Stiller.
On Comedy Central. But I had known Larry since 1984, 85. I met him at Catch a Rising Star when we were all comics together.
Was he
Larry,
funny
Joy,
then?
Larry, me, all of us.
Was he a funny guy in the beginning?
You know, he was hilarious, but the audience had no idea what he was talking about. The comics used to come into the room because he was so unpredictable as a comic. His material was brilliant, but he didn't know how to connect to an audience. You know, he's Larry. You know?
Yeah, he's
and, like,
connects
one person
to
would
Larry.
Look at their watch, and he would storm off or something, you know. Or one person, he would just, sometimes he would walk on stage, he'd just look at the audience and then just go, never mind, and then just walk off.
Oh.
He was so unpredictable that the comics would always come in the room to watch him because you never knew what was going to happen. It was always dangerous. And we all loved hearing his material because we appreciated the brilliance of his writing.
Right. And
he wasn't a great comic, I'll say that.
But he was a great writer.
Great writer. And his being was so funny. I mean, he could have me, we would stand at the bar with him, and he would just, you know, regale us with every dating horror story you can imagine. Me and Joy Behar. And those all then later on became all the George storylines in Seinfeld. And they all really happened to Larry. And Jason tells a story about how he would get a script, Jason Alexander, who played George Costanza in Seinfeld. He would get a script and he would read it and he would say, this is ridiculous. This would never happen to somebody. And Larry would say, it happened to me. It happened to me. And for some reason, the most bizarre things happened to him.
Oh, gosh. And in your own story, you always wanted to be a performer, but you didn't really act on it until things started to happen in a different way in your life.
Well, I was 28 when I first got on stage as a stand-up. Before that, I was, you know, I never thought of being a stand-up comic. It never occurred to me. Because when I was growing up, you know, I'd watch these comics on Ed Sullivan. It would be, you know, Alan King and Jackie
Mason. Right, the old world comics.
Yeah, and they all had these jokes. And that didn't connect to me. It didn't, you know. And then I remember when I saw Richard Pryor in concert, and he was a completely different kind of comic. You know, he was just revealing himself and just so gutsy and accessible and vulnerable and real and funny. That's when I kind of thought about, oh, I could do something like that. You know, that connected to me more. But it never occurred to me to be a comic. I thought I was going to be more of a comedic, like a Carol Burnett, you know, a sketch comic.
Right. But then, of course, you know, you went through the usual. Should you be the best girl possible and do what the family wanted? Go to law school, be a professional? Or could you work through your own anxieties and depressions and break out?
Actually, that period, when I first graduated from college, I guess it was, what were you, 21?
20, 21.
Yeah, and I did apply to law school, and I did get in. But that the moment of thinking I would go lasted maybe 10 minutes, where I knew that wasn't for me. But then I had many years where I was just waitressing and lost and didn't know what to do and depressions and all of that. So it took me a while to figure it out. I remind my kids that all the time because there's so much pressure on these kids that they feel like they have to know what they want in life right away, like out of high school, where they're going to go to college and what they're going to major in. And it doesn't work for some people. Know Jerry Seinfeld knew at 5 he wanted to be a stand-up comic. You know, some people know at 5 they want to be a doctor. A lot of people don't find themselves till later on in life.
Oh, most people. And you know what?
I think so.
Especially your kids are the generation of instant gratification. Everything is sound bites. It has to happen immediately. And that's...
they feel a lot of pressure.
A whole new challenge.
They feel a lot of pressure to know what they can't possibly know. You know, you have to live your life, and you know how it is in life, and then you meet this person, and you end up doing this for a living that you never thought of. And then that person leads you to the next thing, and you kind of have to just keep moving forward and just take every opportunity that's presented to you.
Well, but you're the perfect example, because even though you always had talent, it was like a shadow. It didn't fit you until you really discovered it and started working the clubs, where you actually worked the clubs, got a couple of bucks for it, and had the audience in your pocket.
Right. But, you know, a couple of bucks. We used to work for what's called cab fare.
Right, nothing.
$7 a show.
I still remember in the early days, I love comics, and I used to hang out at the Improv, Bud Friedman's old Improv, in the 40s. And it was incredible, but no one made a nickel out of doing any of that.
No. But then, you know, hopefully we would get gigs. We would do all these Saturday nights at country clubs on Long Island and Jersey. And, you know, then you made maybe in the beginning maybe $60, you know, that kind of a thing. It was a struggle. It was a real struggle. But I had a rent-controlled apartment for $300 a month. And, you know, I lived on Campbell's tomato soup and saltine crackers that I used to steal from the diner.
Oh, my gosh. And you had friends, and you actually were having fun, if you could call
so
it that.
So much fun. No, so much fun. In the 80s, comedy was so big in New York. People would be lined up around the corner every night of the week at the Improv, at Catch a Rising Star, at the Comic Strip. And it was a great, great time, a great scene, and very... you know, very creative. We'd all, on Saturdays, we'd do 5, 6, 7 shows. You'd hop around to different clubs, and, you know, you had cash at the end of the night, and then we'd all at 2 o'clock in the morning go to the diner and talk about our material and talk about, you know, we were all so focused. And I'm talking about, you know, Chris Rock and Colin Quinn and Joy Behar and Mario Cantone and, you know, all
We're all starting out.
On our work. We were all so focused on being good comics. It wasn't about, you know, getting a TV spot. It was about really, really the art form of stand-up that
but,
we were so focused on.
But, Susie, you were really... I'm talking to Susie Essman, who is now in her 9th season playing Susie Green, Curb Your Enthusiasm, on HBO. I'm telling you, I binged on it again the other night. I just needed to laugh. I watched a press conference in the White House, and I thought, you know what? I can't deal with politics anymore.
No,
I just want to laugh at human beings. And
well, that's why, you know, this is why there's always sitcom reruns at 11 o'clock at night.
You need
people,
it.
Yeah, people want to laugh before they go to sleep, and they should. I always tell my husband, do not put on the local news.
Right.
Do not before I go to sleep. It's always like a murder and, you know, something
awful.
And a fire.
But you were really ahead of your time because you were one of the few female comics at that time who talked about sex, your social life, your mother, the whole deal.
You know, now I play on Broad City, which is airing right now.
Yeah, tell everyone what that is in case they haven't done it.
Broad City is this hilariously funny show on Comedy Central with Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson, who play these crazy, you know, 20-something girls who are slackers, basically, which they, in real life, are not. In real life, they're amazingly
workaholics
and hardworking and brilliantly funny and just so original. And I play Alana's mother. And the episode coming up, I believe, is November 8th. And Fran Drescher plays my sister in that episode.
Oh, I love Franny.
Which is great casting, the two of us together. It was just a great, great episode to shoot. But, you know, they always say that they could do what they could do because people like me laid the groundwork for them. And that's always the case. Joan and Phyllis laid the groundwork for me, you know, and it's always the case that somebody is a pioneer, and it makes me happy that they feel that way. I also have another show on, Joan.
What?
In November, called Those Who Can't on True TV, and it's about dysfunctional high school teachers. Very funny. These guys, they're three comedians from Denver, Colorado, and they're just really, really funny. This is the third season of that show. It's worth watching.
You know what? I'm going to watch it.
It's a different kind of humor. It's silly. It's very silly.
But life is good, right, Susie? You're doing a million things. And you're having fun.
I'm having a good time. Going back to Curb is the greatest job I've ever had in my life, ever.
Because you do what you want to do. No script, right?
No script. We improvise. I don't have to memorize lines. I show up on the set. We laugh all day long. And working with Larry David, to get to work with a genius like him, and I don't use that word lightly, is just the greatest job. It's a joy. It is just an absolute joy and a thrill.
Well, and you just can sense it when you watch it. I love it. I just keep hoping that Larry doesn't decide he wants to do another Broadway show. I want him to do this.
I think he's doing another. I think he's working on season 10, but it's not definitive.
Right. But when Larry works on that, because so much is improv, what does he do? The skeleton of an outline?
He does. Well, there's a very detailed outline because Larry's all about story.
Uh-huh.
And when you see the episodes, you see how story dense they are. If you really sit and take it apart and how everything comes back and everything's for a reason, nothing happens in a scene that you don't see a payoff on it. So there's a very detailed outline, about 7-8 pages, and there'll be a paragraph of what each scene is about, what the storyline, what information has to come out in that scene. But there's no dialogue written.
Right, you
so
just
for me,
do
the
it.
The dialogue just writes itself because I know what the scene's about. I know what my relationships are with the other characters. I know who my character is. And it just kind of happens. It's just so much fun.
And to get rid of one's angst with your big mouth, because I've never known you as an angry person, ever.
No, I'm not, because I get it all out on Larry
right.
and Jeff.
Right, good.
And nobody gets hurt. That's the beauty of it. I yell and scream, and nobody gets hurt.
And your marriage on this series is so, I mean, you know, we wouldn't necessarily want that marriage.
No.
But you keep it in hand.
Well, it works for her. You know, a lot of marriages, as we know, because, you know, a lot of marriages are arrangements. You know,
right.
You're not always in love for 50 years. You know, a lot of marriages, people have arrangements that work for them. And my marriage is a love marriage, my Susie Essen marriage. Susie Green's marriage is an arrangement. And she gets what she needs from it, and he gets what he needs from it. And, you know, they're not really happy.
I know. Together. And he's such a cheater. One of the funny ones is when he has an affair or is making love constantly with a realtor because
right.
it's cheap. You don't need to go to a hotel.
You don't need a hotel room. He just goes to open houses.
It's perfect.
It's hilarious.
Hilarious.
And by the way, I hope Larry does a season 10 because I need a new house and a new apartment.
That's for sure. You better tell him. Thank you, Susie. We'll talk soon. Susie Essman, Sunday night at 10 o'clock, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and then Susie's show. When are we going to see the new one, Broad Street.
Broad City, I believe. Broad City. Well, it's airing right now on Wednesday nights on Comedy Central. And I believe that mine is November 8th, my episode.
Okay, I'm excited. We'll see it. Talk to you soon. Bye, Susie. I'm Joan Hamburg. You're listening to WABC.
Stay healthy with the top health specialist in New York with Joan Hamburg, live, local, on it, 77 WABC.
All right, everyone, welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And I recently saw a documentary, a film called Wasted, the story of food waste. You know, when you read that or hear the title, doesn't sound very sexy or you have no idea. Once you see that, the impact on you is extraordinary. You're going to think twice about the way you deal with food. And I want you to meet one of the people used and quoted and photographed in this film is Dan Barba. And Dan is the chef and co-owner of two great restaurants, Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. He wrote an extraordinary book called The Third Plate. And he's always quoted in major publications. He lectures all over the world. He is one of the major opinion makers and decision makers when it comes to food and agriculture. So welcome to you, Dan Barba.
Hello, Joan. Nice to hear your voice.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you for the lovely introduction.
Well, look, who can be better than you? I'm very partial
your
to
son.
Dan.
How about your son?
My son. Dan and my son are close friends. I've known Dan since he was just a little boy. And it was always annoying that he was obsessed with food and so skinny. But it's part of life. So, you know, I, like millions of Americans, are pretty bad when it comes to waste and food. After watching this, you can't do that anymore. Now the farm stands are filled with cauliflower and stuff like that. And I saw myself a couple of weeks ago throwing out all those leaves and rescuing the center, the little white cauliflower.
Nice, yeah.
I know, but then I see this film
and
thought,
like,
what on earth did I... What
I was congratulating because you were eating cauliflower, but you're right. You're wasting 60% of the planet if you're throwing away the leaves.
And it was shocking to find out that a third of everything we all eat is garbage, is wasted. It ends up in a landfill somewhere.
Right.
So what's the deal?
There seems to be like a real consciousness growing, like it's almost like the zeitgeist here with people talking about cutting down on food waste because the numbers are so enormous, and that's a big one. But, you know, the numbers are enormous on a lot of things, like, you know, like global warming, there's numbers that, you know, the depressing facts about the future. What I think is so interesting, provocative about food waste is that people can actually do something about it. You know, you can pull a lever here in your own kitchen and change the world. And that's not, you know, that's not over the top. I mean, that's right.
But let me ask you, and I'm talking to Dan Barba, who is the chef and co-owner of two brilliant restaurants, Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barn, and author of a book called The Third Plate. And you can always read Dan's opinions and attitudes and what's going on in the world of food and environment in all the major publications. If you're not a real cooker, but you are making meals at home, how do you make people want to really do this? Because you open a pop-up restaurant and people are oohing and aahing over things that they had traditionally thought was garbage.
Right, right. So if you're not energized to get in the kitchen and do the work of cooking, say, like cauliflower leaves instead of just the cauliflower. Like, one of the things that I think about a lot and that I actually think is the bigger issue here, not to pivot away from what you're saying, but to actually open it up a bit, is to say that, like, you know, if you're not animated in the kitchen, not energetic in the way that attacks all the stuff that is more difficult to deal with. That's to be honest about it. You know, cauliflower leaves takes longer to cook, and it takes a little bit more creativity and a little bit more time to prep that. Then one way to activate this issue directly and easily is just to think about what's on your plate, whether you're in a restaurant or you're at home. And what I'm talking about here is really meat and how we structure a plate of food. You know, are we insisting twice a day, 7 days a week, that we have a 7 ounce or 6 ounce piece of protein in the center of our plate with like a little bit of grain or vegetable surrounding it, but that the main source of our caloric intake comes from protein, whether it's a chicken breast or a fillet of beef or a center cut of salmon, you know, whatever it is. If that's our way of eating, then I would suggest it's like the most wasteful way to eat. It's the most inefficient way to eat, because to get that protein, you're feeding animals an enormous amount of grain, corn and soybeans and other grains that are taking up enormous amount of lands. If you're not in an enormous amount of acreage, and if you're not eating those grains directly, you're feeding it through an animal, and that's extremely inefficient. And it's extremely wasteful. And so one way just to attack this issue right away, it's not as sexy as, like, you know, going after the ugly fruits and vegetables, or it's not as timely, right, because people are talking about that a lot. The harder issue, the harder thing to do, actually, is to take a real, honest appraisal of what you eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And are you making those proteins so central to your diet that you're aiding and abetting the wastefulness of our food system? And that's a big thing, because just that corn and soy to feed that cow that gave you that steak that centers your plate, you know, that's 120 million acres of grains that we're not eating and we're feeding to an animal. The most inefficient food system in the history of human beings, and it continues that way, and that is the source of our wastefulness. So if you don't want to activate the cauliflower leaves, my suggestion would be to activate what the architecture of your plate looks like, and can you change the architecture? Can you eat more grains? Can you eat more vegetables? And I'm not an advocate for veganism or vegetarianism, as you know. I'm a huge advocate.
No, of eating at all.
But just in the right proportions, yeah.
And so we're really talking about a new kind of food culture.
Yes, I think we are. I think we're talking actually about a food culture that is at once new and also very old. Because if you look at all of the great cuisines of the world, what you were really looking at is what I just described. There is no cuisine, no culture that you can name, that I could name, that has a 6 or 7 ounce piece of protein centered the plate twice a day, 7 days a week. It never existed. And it exists in the Western diet, or really the American diet. And unfortunately, we're exporting that to the rest of the world. But the carrying capacity of the earth doesn't allow that, as we know, as we are seeing. But in terms of wastefulness, it is the most inefficient diet ever created. And what we need to do is really change the food culture. You're right. Turn it on its head. And what I think is so possible about doing that is that it's actually delicious. You know, eating 6 or 7 ounces pieces of protein for lunch and dinner twice a day, 7 days a week, ends up not being that delicious. And you ask any chef, and you alluded to it just now, it's you're taking, you know, not center cuts of the animal, but off cuts, and you're infusing that into grains and vegetables in ways that are really satisfying and delicious and a heck of a lot less wasteful.
Well, that's it. Dan started some pop-up restaurants, one here in New York at his Blue Hill in the Village on Washington Street, on Washington Place, right there, and one in London, too. And my daughter happened to be in London during one of the last days of the pop-up, and she said, you wouldn't believe how extraordinarily delicious this food is, but you're an extraordinary chef.
But these ingredients, you're really talking about the stuff that's just infused with tons of flavor.
Well, explain. You know? Just give a few examples
about. Just what you were talking about and what I've eaten in your own home are just offcuts of animals. You're not looking at the loin and the rack of lamb. You're looking at the leg and the shoulder of lamb. And I always talk to you about the leg of lamb.
I know.
It changed my life. That was the epiphany moment for what food could be when you gave me this marinated lamb that you had.
It's so funny
I'm funny, but it's the truth. It's like you were taking a cut that's not as popular. You were marinating. It was leftovers, essentially, I think, from a dinner party, and you had been marinating it extra long time. And there you took a little culinary craft and a little bit of a hungry adolescent, and you had, you know, the perfect mixture for a delicious meal. And that was not a center cut piece of protein. That was, you know, that was an off cut, really. And it was just prepared really well. So that's why chefs get really excited about this, and why the film, and why this movement, in large part of this food movement against waste, is led by chefs, because chefs are all about taking off cuts, whether it's meats or vegetables or grains.
And being innovative.
Yeah, and being innovative. That's our craft. And that's what we're, that's in our DNA. It's also in our DNA not to waste this stuff, because we're a parsimonious crew. Not out of ethics, but because of the economics of running a restaurant are so thin that you know, you need to be very careful about what you throw away.
Wasted, the story of food waste. And here's the thing. I'm not good about leftovers, or I was not. It's that film will definitely change the way you deal with this. And of course, the whole thing is like the marketing, so that you get people to pay attention and to understand they don't have to be Dan Barber or Mario Batali or Anthony Bourdain in their kitchens. They just have to be sensitive and more aware of how they can change the way they eat. And it's actually a healthier way to eat.
Yeah, for sure. No, there's no question about it. And more pleasurable. I mean, that's the thing where I think the shiv is here. It's like, this is about hedonism. You know, this isn't about a dictate from, you know, high-end chef is telling you need to be more responsible. I mean, it's just really, it's about like, let's be more pleasurable and more thoughtful about how we engage with food in the world. And that's you know, as long as it's delicious, it's a winning idea. It's a winning formula. Part of the problem with things like the environmental movement is always asking to give up stuff. It's depressing in the end. And in the end, it's hard to activate that stuff in everyday life. This is actually pretty easy. You're voting with your fork, as Michael Pollan likes to say, and we get to do it three times a day.
Right. You can definitely, you know, it brought back when I was a kid. I still remember my grandmother going to, I mean, they didn't go necessarily to markets. They went to the poultry guy to buy live chickens. And I remember the excitement when my mother and her mother would find unborn eggs. You know, a lot of people are like, ooh, what's that? But they were a delicacy, and she would poach them in homemade chicken broth.
Yeah.
They were so good. And
who did that? Your
my grandmother and my mother.
Yeah.
You know, that was before Wolbaum's became Mecca. In those days.
But what you're talking about is a wasted product. I mean, today, there's no culture for eating that. They're completely thrown away. We use it at the restaurant, but, you know, in our
time. You shave it.
Yeah, shave it, exactly. Yeah.
You do that. So do you notice when people come to Blue Hill, well, you give them, you know, a bunch of stuff.
No, but when we serve things like that, what you were just describing, onboard eggs, those are the eggs when you slaughter an egg-laying chicken when it's at the end of its life. It has eggs in it lined up sort of like LaGuardia Airport, ready to hatch, you know, get a shell and hatch. And we take those and cure them and either dry them and shave them or poach them in a broth. It's amazing that your grandmother was Jewish, and there is a Jewish tradition. But when we serve this, you know, they invariably have, you know, a Cantonese woman come in and said, "Oh my God,
they did it."
There's this dish, and then you have Taiwanese person come in, and you have a Russian. It's just incredible that every culture dealt with an edible you know, what to them was an edible delicacy in a way that, you know, infused in their memory and their culture. And with us, you know, we just don't have, as you said, we don't have the culture for it. We don't have the language for it.
No.
And we should, because it's so delicious and also is a way to look at cutting down waste that you know, is quite provocative.
Yeah, no, Americans speak steak. You know, people keep saying, oh, no, they're vegans, they're vegetarians. But you go to any steakhouse, and they're four deep, even at the bar, right, waiting to be seated.
Right. That's right. That's right. So we really need to change the culture around. And look, I'm not anti-steak.
Mr.
Hamburg. I love a great steak, but I just don't enjoy it, and most chefs don't enjoy it out of proportion. And,
right,
and,
like,
you know,
12 ounces.
Yeah, exactly. Out of 12 ounces, and more than a couple of times during the course of a month. You know, and that's the way all cultures dealt with steaks, which are center cuts of beef. You know, those were celebratory cuts, high on the hog. You know, those are all center cuts that one ate at holidays and at special occasions. And the rest of the time, you had the off cuts and you made these beautiful, wonderful stews and dishes.
Right, they braised.
Right, you braised a ton because, and it makes perfect sense because that's how you tenderize those parts and you get them to sing. And it's not that hard actually to do a braise. You can at home. You can take an off cut of meat, whether it's from the leg or the shoulder, and marinate it like you did with olive oil, a little bit of garlic for 2 days. You don't have to do anything. And you can stick it in water. You know, people talk about having you have to braise in stock. You don't. You can do a little bit of water. You stick an onion and a carrot in there. And
there you have it. And it's something good. And what else I remember is that we always had a lot of people for dinner when we were children, always.
Yeah.
And nothing was wasted. And they would, you know, big meals every night. And whatever was left over, whether it was a roast or a turkey or a chicken, that would all be in the faithful old meat grinder.
Yeah,
and
to make
be,
the sausage.
Exactly,
sausage.
And baked along with whatever else was happening.
That's right. That's right. That's why these dishes that you look back at these cuisines like sausage is a great example of utilization of all the parts, utilization of meats that you don't eat right after the slaughter, but so is the whole cuisine. I mean, you look at coq au vin. I mean, coq au vin is what? It's a rooster. You know, try eating a rooster.
Yeah, it's tough.
It tastes like a piece of wood. Unless
you braise it
very slowly in oxidized white wine, which is what the French Burgundy community figured out, and it became so delicious and infused itself into the culture in a way that it's one of the more iconic French dishes, as is bouillabaisse. Bouillabaisse was the dish that the wives of fishermen kept back from selling because no one would buy it, and it was damaged fish, it was uncoveted fish, and they made a beautiful stew out of it and called it bouillabaisse. They didn't call it wasted fish and didn't point the finger at you and say eat your fish.
Yeah, leftover.
Right, exactly. No, it's a bouillabaisse, and that becomes one of the more iconic French dishes as well. But we have that in every culture and cuisine. We just don't have it in American cooking because we were never forced into those kind of negotiations of figuring out, you know, what the land could supply or the ocean could supply and maneuvering in a way that fed the community, because we were such a rich country. In many ways, we still are. And that's unfortunate because it has created a food culture that's based on waste because we've been able to waste. And all these other cultures, whether it's been Europe or Asia or anywhere else in the world, those soils have been exhausted over the course of centuries, and peasants, largely peasants, have figured out a way, had to figure out a way to eke out what the land could supply and make it delicious and nutritious. We just were never forced into those negotiations. And that's what I think you're talking about is we need to change the culture. And I believe chefs are a good place to start. They're, you know, to make a call for them to be the modern day peasants is maybe too much of a stretch. But they have a broadcasting power now and they influence the food culture in ways that we didn't 20 years ago. And so that's a powerful way to think about, you know, how we change people's expectations for dinner.
Right. And, you know, Americans used to think that you go to a restaurant, it was a great restaurant if the plate could not be seen because the portions were so enormous.
Yeah.
And that is all changing thanks to chefs like Dan Barba. Dan is not only a chef, but he's co-owner, and you've got to try them if you never have. Blue Hill in Manhattan, in Greenwich Village, and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is a spectacular place. And the only day that you serve lunch in Stone Barns, right, is on Sunday.
Yeah, we do. We serve all day, but otherwise we're not in the lunch business.
Right. Well, it's a real treat to try this and understand how exciting this way of eating can be. And to see Wasted, you can go to select theaters or on demand right in the comfort of your own home.
Thank you,
Dan.
Thank you so much. Nice to hear your voice.
Okay, honey. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome to Hour 2 of the Joan Hamburg Show. We're together until 3 o'clock. And by the way, you know, the podcast is so popular. And it's easy. Like, we're available all the time, every day of the week. Just go to wabcradio.com. The Joan Hamburg Show, and there we are. And, of course, on Facebook and on Twitter. we're sort of everywhere. And we always love to hear from you and to see you. Lots of stuff going on in this town. The theater is roaring in, which is exciting. This is really the time to decide what you want to see. Amy Schumer is coming in, a Steve Martin production. And do you know, she is selling tickets like you wouldn't believe. Crazy. It's terrific. Why not? It's like Bette Midler. Bette broke every record at this theater that she's been in for the best shows. We love Bette Midler. And she's certainly done great on Broadway, and everyone is very happy to see her. You can't resist these kind of shows. Hello, Dolly. She's one of the great stars. So for this hour for you, we have two Melissas. We have movie star Melissa, who has just opened yesterday in a new movie called Novitiate. And it's about a convent and about nuns and about what motivates people. What is it that calls them to religion? Where do they get this passion and true love for young girls? So, of course, the world has changed a lot, but we'll talk about that. And Melissa Rivers is coming over. Melissa Rivers, she writes, she produces, she performs. She's a terrific horsewoman, too. So imagine growing up in that family where your mother is front and forward all the time. And everything is fuel for that great comedy machine. Not easy, but she's a very solid young woman. I've always been fond of her. So it's fun to talk to her, and she did a great job. You know, Joan Rivers never threw out one single thing. Now, I live with a man who never throws out anything, but it isn't nicely organized in card files. It's everywhere. Joan Rivers was meticulous. A to Z, everything card files. There isn't a joke that she doesn't have on file. So you're going to be very interested in hearing her. And don't forget, we have, of course, Halloween on Tuesday. My whole building takes over. They decorate from head to foot. It's spectacular. Really, they do a great job. And then the kids, you sign up and the kids come from floor to floor. If you live in the suburban areas, it's sort of a novel thing. But the elevator is your transportation and you get all that candy. And I was telling our group here, Duane Reade and CVS, it's CVS actually, that has a 2-for-1 giant bag or bags. And of course, who doesn't love this kind of candy? This is my favorite holiday and my worst holiday. I can't stop eating it. I wasn't going to. But you know what they don't have, which I love? Goldenberg's peanut chews. Very hard to find. Have to go online and get it at Amazon. So we're diverting. The marathon is coming in a week from Sunday. A big event in New York City. They're already, if you go through Central Park, the stands are up. So you can see. And people come. I see them. They're already here in the city. When I come into the station, you see men and women in shorts racing all over the streets, getting themselves warmed up. It's really fun to watch. It's interesting. I never wanted to be in a marathon, maybe an eating marathon, but not in one of these running marathons, although I love to see it. It's really great. And I have to warn you, I did not grow up in the city, but I moved here when I went to Barnard College, and I sort of never went back. The quality of life in New York City, in Manhattan, has never been worse. There isn't a street that isn't dug up. Not one street. It takes me sometimes 45 minutes to get from my home, which is in Manhattan, not that far uptown, to this station on 33rd Street. We go east, west, west, east, because construction is everywhere. My street has been blocked off for weeks. You can't even get to our door So if you're going anywhere or bringing groceries, you've got a real issue. It's dirty. It's noisy. I don't know what's going on. It's like no one's watching. We never used to have every street involved in construction. But with that said, I'd still rather live here than any place in the world. I love this town, and it's a town where everything is still possible. Meanwhile, guys, settle back and enjoy, because we have a great hour or two coming up, and you're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
All right, everyone. Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And I saw a film recently, an incredibly powerful film called Novitiate, and one of the stars is Academy Award-winning actress Melissa Leo. And Melissa does a really remarkable job. The story revolves around a convent that has to deal with what went on in the Catholic Church in the end of the 50s and the 60s during Vatican II, all the changes, the attempt to modernize the Catholic Church. And she plays the Reverend Mother. This is not The Sound of Music. And the Reverend Mother, complicated, troubled, passionate, cruel, everything you can think of. Congratulations, Melissa. A really spectacular performance.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
No, really interesting. And the story, and we're not going to give everything away, the film is at the Angelica and a couple of other places in New York City. And I'm sure it will ultimately be in your own backyard. But it's about a youngster who suddenly feels she has a religious calling. She's heard it, and she wants to enter a convent. And at the time this young woman and this whole class of beautiful, innocent young girls enter the convent is the time when the Vatican Council, the Second Council, is about to get underway. And it leads to reforms. But I'm curious, Melissa, what happened? Where did this enter your life?
Well, I actually was doing a reading of another script, hoping to get some interest and shoot that film, which eventually I did. But I met, who came along to the reading, a lovely producer, and Margaret Betts, the writer-director of Novitiate. And they said, you know, we'd like you to do this. You would like to play the Reverend Mother. And they sort of had me there. I have always wanted to play a nun.
That's so funny.
I would be hazarding a guess as to why for you know, in truth, but I know there's Joan of Arc and Agnes of God and, you know, other points of reference through my life. A great costume, my gosh, a costume to
That's
beat
right.
all costumes. So identifiable, so restraining in a very interesting way. So I was delighted to be asked.
Were you Catholic?
I went. No, I was raised in New York City with really no religious anything, you know, for a long time. I probably hazarded a guess I might be Jewish, but the Jews didn't seem to think I was Jewish. But we went to Passover from time to time with friends.
Yeah, everyone goes to Passover.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a great time was had by all. Oh, but I, no, and in a way, for me as an actor, that's always almost more interesting, to be able to reach for a role, to be able to deliver for the filmmaker the character they need for their film, and not something burdened with my own ideas of, you know, Catholicism or religion or whatever the subject might be.
And, you know, watching the film for me was absolutely fascinating. When I was a little kid, I had a babysitter who was probably young herself, very young, and the most religious Catholic you can imagine. And the minute my family, you know, would say goodbye to her, she would take me and take me to church every day to Mass. She convinced me that if I didn't pray, I was going to go to you know where.
Oh, my God.
And as a kid, I really believed it. I was so scared for my brother, for the whole family.
Yeah.
So I loved watching this because not only does this explore what goes on through the heads and bodies of these young girls and what they have to endure, but for me, it was about why do people become obsessed with religion or choose to devote themselves to faith? It's just an amazing journey.
It is, and it's, you know, we have to really remember as we talk about it, because our that convent, as it were, which is actually just a school down in Tennessee, that is our location, it was a delight to be able to shoot in this one place. It held our cathedral and our dining hall and our cells even. So that was, you know, it really informed us. We could really believe we were inside that convent working on it. But still in all, it's a motion picture.
Right.
It's not a document. That's Catholic Church.
You know, exactly.
We're all playing characters that, you know, to the best of our abilities, that may be an example of what it was like to be a nun and maybe just a very interesting film.
Right. And taken place at a time when revolutionary changes were just peaking up from the Catholic Church. But how did you prepare for the Mother Superior?
Well, Reverend Mother was, you know, I did not have much time prior to starting. I did speak with a couple of ex-nuns who had taken their time within the convent very seriously, were still both of them Catholic, but did not feel that the life of the nun was really for them after some time. Did not seem to do much with Vatican II for these two women I spoke to, but... you know, what I discovered is that as many nuns as there have ever been, there are as many different nuns as
exactly.
you could imagine. You know, we're all just who we are in the end, and even a rigorous training, an army training, still in all, each soldier is their own person still. Same with the nuns, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And right after Vatican II, after all that started, I even read in your film that thousands of nuns left convents or everywhere during that time.
Well, this is numbers I can't, you know, I do see that on the film. I don't know. I don't know the facts of it for myself, so I can only go, yeah, no, it's quite possible. And maybe it was also, I was born in 1960. I remember that time of great, vast change, and I think there was a lot of change going on in a lot of ways at that time. But I think what you keep bringing up, Vatican II, I think for my character, Reverend Mother, it was devastating. It was an insult and nothing but to not have been at all held counsel to make this understanding, to annihilate in one fell swoop this notion that's not, for Reverend Mother, an idea, but she had a husband and that was God. She believed that. There was no seeking any longer. She was in it for 40 years of her life, her whole life.
With such love and conviction.
No, thank you.
No, I'm telling you, the film was very powerful and very touching. And Melissa, you just sort of took it because the character had so many layers that, and you certainly you have done tons of things in the film world, in television, you've done a ton of things. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm very lucky, girl. I'm back working with Mr. Denzel Washington and Mr. Antoine Fuqua over in Boston. We're getting another Equalizer out.
Oh, how exciting.
So fun to be working with those fellows, the both of them, in each in very different and delightful ways, such talented men. And then in another month or two, I'll head back out to California and make a second season of I'm Dying up here with Showtime.
How great. So this is really a good time.
I'm having a good time. Thank you so much for asking.
That's the way. Is your son an actor?
No, my son is a fine artist who's over in Germany now studying fine art. Yeah.
Where is he? Is he in Berlin?
In Frankfurt studying, yeah. And I think soon we'll be living in Berlin because isn't that the city to be in Germany?
Oh, and not only is that the city to be in, it's a city whose art culture is extraordinary right now.
Yeah.
Really something to see.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because your parents were not theater people. Your mom, as I recall reading, was a teacher, and your dad was an editor.
Yeah, an editor who then eventually turned into a commercial fisherman out on the east end of Long Island.
And as a kid, was that shocking to you, or that's just what dads did?
Well, there was a lot of shock in my upbringing. I mean, who doesn't get a little shock or two? No, we were a happy little family on East 10th Street for many years. And then, of course, there was the separation and the great fast changes.
Right.
And I'm sure in any role I play, that history of mine comes along, consciously or not.
No, but you have all these dimensions, and that's what adds to it.
Something like maybe.
Yeah, but look, you started all my children. You started getting awards really early and nominations. Well, all the best to you, Melissa. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Melissa Leo. And her film is In Our Own Backyard, Novitiate. You're going to hear a lot about it. It actually has been talked about. Are you thrilled with all the excitement that this film is garnering?
Well, we don't do the work for nobody to see it.
Right.
So come on out and see Novitiate, please.
All right. All the best to you and yours. We'll talk again.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hamburg. Thank you.
Pleasure. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
From food to fun and so much more, The Joan Hamburg Show, exclusively on 77 WABC.
I love kitchenware and wonderful pots and pans, and my favorites are Le Creuset. And not only do I have them, but for years I bought them every holiday for my kids, so they too could have the pleasure of cooking in them. And if you've never done a chicken in one of these Le Creuset casseroles, you have no idea what a treat it is. So when Le Creuset came out with a collection of recipes from their French table, I was really interested. And I love the recipes. They are very simple to cook with and really delicious, whether it's a vegetable, a cauliflower, a polonaise, whether it's a coq au vin, which a lot of you probably haven't made in a long time, but it's a very simple, wonderful recipe, a pot au creme. I want you to meet Nate Collier, who manages all the cooking and culinary programs for Le Creuset of America, including the recipe development, the test kitchen, the products, and very involved in this project. So thanks for joining us, Nate.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, who can resist these fabulous pots? And they're absolutely my favorite. And whether you're doing a poulet, a roast chicken, or, as I said, the coq au vin, which can really, it needs a fantastic pot. So explain to me how you guys picked the recipes.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm so glad to hear that you love cooking in the cookware, because, you know, that's exactly how we feel, and that's exactly how we want to make everyone else feel. You know, this book was really aimed to empower people to make joy through cooking and kind of not be so intimidated by French cooking anymore. You know, and it's a timely book because, you know, French cooking is now kind of having a small resurgence.
Right.
You know, there's some best new restaurants that are now getting back to French cooking. And I think the book is great because, you know, those of us that were around to experience and see kind of what Julia Child did for French cooking a number of years ago in this country are going to love kind of revisiting that type of cuisine. And then for, you know, those younger or newer cooks that weren't around for that, this is a great introduction to start cooking that for the first time. And that's kind of where we started is, you know, Le Creuset has been producing cookware in France for nearly 100 years. So we've been a part of that French culinary heritage for for a long time. Everything from simple peasant meals shared around a family table all the way up to, you know, refined French haute cuisines and restaurant kitchens. And, you know, we just wanted to bring that whole spectrum of French cooking to home cooks in the States with, you know, with updated taste profiles and maybe talking about the technique in a more approachable way. And that's where we started. So you'll find a lot of classics. You'll find, you know, some new twists on classics. You'll find some straightforward French classics.
But you made them easy, and that's what I like. You know, when I was at a screening for the Julia, for the movie about Julia, and the, I remember the young woman who was cooking through every one of her recipes,
right.
And at the book party, I don't know if you guys were there or involved, they served bœuf bourguignon, which, you know, were we lucky, because I've never had that at a screening or a party. But I love your recipe for bœuf bourguignon. And also, when we were coming of age and trying to impress our dates, Steak Diane was top of the list. I don't think my kids ever heard of that.
And, you know, and I love to hear that, because that's kind of what, you know, we want to do is evoke some of those memories that you have that you're talking about, but also recreate some of those memories with a new generation. And that's what, you know, frankly, Licorice Lake Cookware is all about, because it lasts for generations. You know, you can create memories for so long. But that's, you know, those are the types of recipes that are in here. Beef bourguignon, you really can't get more classic French than that. You know, beef bourguignon in a Licorice Dutch oven. You know, there are a number of steps to the dish, but we've made it a little bit more approachable to people so they feel like they could cook it. And what's great about this book is we gave little tidbits both on tips, on techniques, on ingredients, on the cookware to kind of give you a little bit more information, but in a very approachable, non-technical voice. And we gave great little tidbits and stories behind some of the recipes, or maybe behind a region or behind an ingredient. So when you're serving these dishes to your guests, you've got a, you know, a fun anecdote to tell that you've learned about something in French cooking. So it's a more fun, familiar way to approach the cuisine.
Right. And you did a good job with fish, because a lot of people don't like to do fish at home because they simply don't know how to cook it.
Right.
And you're taking the fish and doing it in parchment in many cases, or searing it, or doing a bouillabaisse, which is not that hard to put together when you do that.
You're right, it's not. And I think just, you know, some people, when they hear those names, when they hear bouillabaisse,
they're scared.
They hear, fish in papillote, they're scared. But if you really read the recipe, it's just, you know, folding some fresh vegetables and a fresh piece of fish up in some parchment paper and putting in the oven. And it really is as simple as that. But boy, is it impressive when you put it on the table and cut open the parchment and you know.
That all comes out. It's so delicious.
Out, and, you know, it looks like you've been working for hours, but really it was pretty simple to put.
Right.
Together.
And your coquille à Saint-Jacques, another thing that was popular in my sort of youth and then went out of style. And then you not only do this recipe using wonderful scallops, but tips like don't look for the snow white scallops, which people might think of the way to go, because they've probably been bleached in preservatives.
Exactly. And, you know, and those are the types of tips we want to arm people with, because really at the end of the day, you know, French cuisine has always been rooted in very fresh, of course, at first very regional ingredients, and cooking them kind of simply and taking care of them. And so that's, you know, the first step is getting great ingredients and then knowing about them, so you can pass that tip along to somebody else. And we love for people to share that with their friends, of course.
Yeah, and you've got a really nice snapper recipe in here, which you use with asparagus and mushroom blends, all kinds of good things, and yet very easy.
And, you know, it is. And the other thing I love about this book is we put together things where, you know, there's something in here for the novice cook. There's something in here for the more experienced cook. There's something in here for you when you want to, you know, really get involved and cook all day long on a Sunday. And there's something in here for when you really only have 45 minutes and want to throw a nice dinner together on a weeknight. And there really is all of those different approaches in there to take. And that's what I also love about it as well. There's something for everybody.
Nate Collier is in charge of all the cooking programs for Le Creuset, including the test kitchen and recipe development. So what's your favorite? If you can eat anything, Nate, what would it be?
Well, I'll have to give you two. I think one of my favorite recipes in here is our coq au vin recipe, because, like you said, it really is just a simple braised chicken. But what we did was we cooked it in sparkling wine instead of the traditional red wine.
Yeah, I thought, what was that?
Well, part of it, when that recipe was first written, it was a really old rooster, and you kind of needed that robust
tough
red wine to take away some of the gamey flavor and tenderize the meat. And with today's fresh chickens, we don't need that as much. But also, I love it because, people don't think about cooking with sparkling wine, so it's a fun thing to pass along. And B, it adds this nice kind of fresh, crisp flavor to it, even still being a nice, hearty, warm dish for fall. It just adds this nice crisp flavor profile to it. And that's another thing we talk about in the book. French cuisine, like I said, is very regional based. So if you happen to live in a region in France that produced great sparkling wine, that's what you were going to cook with, and that's what you were going to drink. It doesn't always have to be red wine. So hopefully, of course, people will take that and find something fun there. But then again, at the end of the day, we're really just teaching the technique. So if you wanted to swap out for red wine, you absolutely could. If you wanted to swap out for white wine or even beer, you really could use the exact same technique with that recipe and come up with something delicious. And my other favorite recipe in there would definitely have to be just the simple palm frites, because I love a good French fry. It's just something so simple, just potatoes and oil and salt. But those things that are so simple, you really have to take care with the technique, and it's not hard, but if you listen to the frying it twice to get that nice fluffy interior and the nice crisp exterior, those are the things we want to teach people how to do, because if you are going to serve something as simple as a palm frites, you better be delicious. Exactly.
It better be delicious. Well, there's a lot of delicious recipes in Le Creuset. I'm going to spell it C-R-E-U-S-E-T, and it's, if you never owned a Le Creuset casserole or a pot or whatever, you've got to look for it, because they're lasting a lifetime. And this is a collection of recipes from their French table. Thank you, Nate. All the best to you.
Thank you so much. And everyone can look for more information on the book, and of course, purchase it at lecreuset.com and find out more about the cookware as well.
Perfect. Take care. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
All right, everyone, welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. And I have in front of me quite a fabulous book, Joan Rivers Confidential. And it's by Melissa Rivers and Scott Curry. It's the scrapbooks, the joke cards, the personal files, the photographs. I'm reading this from the cover of a very funny woman who kept everything. And Melissa, your mom would have loved this book. It would have been right in her living room.
Absolutely. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Melissa. You did a great job.
You? Thank you. I think she would have enjoyed it.
She would have enjoyed it. She would have been proud of it. And even your mother, the greatest workhorse of all times, would not have believed all the accumulation. I can't believe it. Did you know your mom kept everything she ever said?
Yes. We lived with the joke file in our house. But, my father was a meticulous record keeper. My mother was a meticulous record keeper. So when the two of them got together, everything was kept on file. Most of it was all in storage.
It's amazing, too, how you and your mom, your relationship really developed over the years.
We were always mother and daughter, but we really, truly became partners and, a performing team.
Melissa's the co-creator of the Red Carpet franchise, the host and executive producer of the E! Entertainment Fashion Police series, has written best-selling books, and has done a great job on this book. Fantastic photographs. So, Melissa, at one point your mom had said to me, I think I'm going to move in with my daughter. And we were all sort of taken aback, because I could just see my own kids rolling their eyes in horror.
Yes. And we, my mother was like, I'm going to move in with her, and it's going to be a reality show.
That's your mom.
And that's my mom. And I have to say, you know, it was complicated. And, you know, through the end of her life, she lived with me 3 days a week when she would be out in L.A. for Fashion Police. And as difficult as that could be for someone having their parent, even just like a normal parent, live with them, and you can only imagine the heightened version of that with
exactly.
my mom.
Yeah, and you have a child.
Well, it really forged such a relationship and such a bond between her and my son because they were together all the time.
Oh, your mother. I mean, all grandparents or most adore their children, but your mother went berserk. I think it even shocked her, the intensity of her feelings for this child.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it was really sort of a life-changing moment for her. And I think it was the one time in her life that she felt successful.
Interesting, isn't it?
That sort of, the whole idea of family and the next generation. And those two took one look at each other, and that was that.
And your mother, not only her relationships, but she really had friendships with everyone, including Prince Charles. This just wasn't a lot of BS.
No, these were the letters and things that I put in the book. You know, were real friendships, especially with the royal family and with the Reagans. And those were very long, genuine friendships.
And she even went, which was extraordinary, she went to when Charles married Camilla Parker Bowles. She actually was one of the few people invited to that wedding.
Yes. So, you know, again, what I represent in the book are these, you know, not just fun correspondence, but real heartfelt correspondence between people who had long, you know, long friendships and spent real time together.
At what point did it become easier for you to be the daughter of your mother, in your face, right there?
Well, you got to remember, my mother was, you know, it wasn't the Joan Rivers you knew in public or on stage.
No.
It isn't the one I lived with.
Right.
You know, so it takes time to sort of...
Any daughter and mother.
With any daughter and mother. So, you know, or anyone who has a parent who is successful in their business and you choose to go into the same thing. It's you know, it's just that our story about it was on TV. And, you know, but you don't really think of your parent that way. You think of, you know, I think of my mom as my mom.
Right.
You know, and I think I realized sort of her impact and her historical importance in the world of comedy after she passed, because that's only time that you get perspective on those things.
Right. And how is your son doing?
He's doing great. He's 16.
Oh, my gosh. It's almost time for him to go to college.
Yeah, he's a junior in high school, and, you know, she would be so proud of him.
Yeah, well, he's a great kid.
And Nancy would be enjoying the fact that, you know, I have a teenager that's torturing me. She would find endless amusement in that.
No, it's hard anytime. When you really decided that this is what you were going to do, and you've always been very talented, you always could write, you did some terrific producing, still doing it, was your mother approving of this, or she knew how hard it was?
You know, I sort of made that decision before my dad passed. Mm-hmm. And as they like to say, we are supportive yet not encouraging.
That's, I like that.
Yes, because, and I would say, how could you say that? And they're like, my mother's like, why would anyone want their child to go into a business that is 90% no? That you are rejected and told no 90% of the time.
Not easy.
Not easy.
You know what? I never could. And it's when you read and see this book, it's a story of a whole different time. But Joan Rivers' story, even that amazing documentary that was, you know, put out a couple of years ago, I never, and I'm very high energy and sort of kinetic. No one had. Your mother would work all day, get on a red-eye plane, and come back and do stand-up.
She loved what she did.
I know, but she still...
Yes. She had a crazy amount of energy and an insane work ethic. But she did also know how to unwind, and she would sort of block those little bits of time. She was the kind of person that could go 2 weeks straight and then get into bed and sleep for an entire weekend.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was just sort of how she was wired. But yeah, the work ethic was just overwhelming. And it took me a long time to make peace with that because I have a crazy work ethic. But I always felt like I was lazy and not doing enough because comparing myself to my mother. And about, I guess it was about 3 years before she passed, and I was feeling, my mom's like, you've got to take time off, you've got to relax, you've got to do this. And I'm like, why? You don't. And she looked at me and she goes, I'm not normal.
That's
so at least she acknowledged,
That
it was that was not the thing to necessarily completely emulate.
I know, but in a way, she admired that in you too and was proud that you had that ethic and that nothing stopped you guys.
Yes, that's true.
No matter what it was. And even when things weren't always the best, you still understood the lesson that you got to get up and step over it and keep going.
Absolutely. My mother, and that's the thing, is everyone's like, did your mom know she had these kinds of records and archives? I said, I'm sure somewhere in the back of her mind she did, but she never looked backwards. But that's what kept her comedy so fresh.
Right.
She never looked backwards, ever.
No. And she used everything and everyone.
Absolutely.
And if it didn't work, she didn't just stand there and die on stage. She just would keep on going.
Yes, and that's one of the things she taped, recorded all of her acts, all of her performances.
Oh, you see, that's amazing.
Yeah, because she wanted to go back and listen to what worked and what didn't work and why.
I'm talking to Melissa Rivers, Joan Rivers' daughter, and a talent in her own right. Melissa has done a lot of amazing things, including bringing up a now 16-year-old boy. She produces television, writes books, is on air. So what you've done this amazing book, a real tribute to your mother and to a different time. What is it now, if you could be anything, what is it you would do?
I'd be asleep.
Yes. not a Rivers.
I've got two shows that are about to, you know, come out, so I'm still working very much in that vein. I'm kind of trying to figure out what my next book is, but I think it'll be much more in the vein of Book of Joan, sort of more short-form stories.
Right.
And I'm just sort of trying to get my head around what that's going to be next. I mean, luckily, we're almost at Thanksgiving, so I'm giving myself I'm looking forward to having a weekend of breathing.
Now, are you going to come to New York, or are you going to stay in L.A.?
We now do. I've taken over for my mother, and now everyone comes to L.A. for Thanksgiving.
Right. Joan Rivers always had Thanksgiving. And it's so interesting because I remember I went over to your mother's apartment one day, and she was having a dinner, and the table was set. And it was years ago. This unbelievable table with all the accoutrements. It was the antithesis of what people who didn't know that side of your mom, you know, they see her as this bawdy, in-your-face stand-up. And here's this other side, this Baccarat crystal, this beautiful table.
Yeah, this very sort of refined, elegant life. And she loved to entertain, and I have definitely for all of our big parties, and especially for Thanksgiving, I have all the dishes, and we use the
same. So you kept all that. I'm glad.
Yes. So I'm able to have that same kind of feeling at my big parties, but most importantly at Thanksgiving, where my cousins now come out to California. And, you know, it's amazing because the next generation, meaning Cooper and my cousin's children, they all know the dishes. They all go, oh, those are our Thanksgiving dishes.
Right.
You know what I mean? They all...
That's right. It's part of their heritage.
It's part of their heritage, and it's so important for me to still have that moment every year.
Now, is Cooper a funny kid? Although
yes.
at 16, most yes. kids aren't funny.
Oh, God. But let me tell you, sarcasm doesn't play so well out of a 16-year-old speaking to its parent.
No. You have to get through it. This, too, shall pass.
Yes. But I have to say, I can't get that mad because he does come by it honestly.
Right.
But, you know, he's got to learn to get... I just got him a T-shirt that says, next sarcastic comment in 3, 2, 1.
That's very funny.
To remind him that when he is, as funny as we all know he is, he's got to remember his age.
I know. You want to know one of the, I think I told this, your mother and I were talking about our kids one day, and I said that for a holiday, I bought my daughter Lizzie, who also had a really big mouth as a kid, and I bought her a pillow. And it said, mirror, mirror on the wall, I have become my mother after all.
Yes.
And I thought, perfect.
Yes, you know? And I have a pillow that says, if it's not one thing, it's your mother.
That's, it's, we need that.
Yes.
Thank you, Melissa. Come visit me, honey.
Thank you. Love you. So good to hear your voice.
We'll talk to you soon. Joan Rivers Confidential, a gorgeous book available in all the bookstores right now.
Thank you.
A pleasure, Melissa. Stay tuned. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.